What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Central Virginia Sport Performance Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jay DeMayo, and today I am fired up get to catch up and talk a little shop here with Dr. Craig Turner. Doc, how are we doing today, man?
Jay, doing great. Thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, man. I appreciate your flexibility. Both of us being in the middle of conference basketball season makes these connections at times difficult. So first, before, thanks for your flexibility with being able to find time and get this down. But secondly, before we get too far into this, let's give everybody really, the quick little elevator pitch. Who is Dr. Turner? How did you get up to Penn? And let's roll from there, brother.
For sure. So I'll give you the Spark Notes version, because originally I'm from Oldham, England, just outside of Manchester. So originally from the UK, and that's kind of where I started off within the kind of realm of sport, taking kind of more of an academic route, Liverpool John Moores, where I did my bachelor's, master's and PhD. During that time, with the kind of research aspect side of things, I was lucky enough to be funded by Nike. So I had kind of the early start of my career, my kind of first career job, as I call it. Being a strength conditioning coach, sports scientist, was a part of the Nike soccer academy, or football academy, as we would call it back home. And I spent essentially 5 years a part of kind of Nike's sports research lab and doing this kind of more applied research, strength and conditioning with the soccer academy, whilst also being in conjunction with the university there. And then I was lucky enough to get a move out to the US. I kind of fell in love with the US during my time at Nike, and I got an opportunity at NC State with the Wolfpack under Nate Brookerson. He was a great friend of mine, mentor, and managed to spend 2 years there before moving on and getting a role within the NBA. Originally, I had a soccer background, as I kind of talked about. So it was kind of my first ever true basketball role. So I managed to blag some people there in some ways. Spent 2 years there, and then now I'm over at UPenn, heading up head of basketball performance there, and also kind of involved in our applied sports science perspectives for kind of our 33 sports that we have at the university.
I love it, man. And Nate's such a great dude to have around and to be able to get to bounce things off of. And he's obviously spoken exceptionally high of you and the work that you've done. But I really think that what's cool and what is unique with what you bring to the world of basketball as a former college soccer player is, your unique perspectives of how you look at things, both through training and through the applied sports science aspect, because of your big soccer background.
For sure. I think, when we think about team sports, right, there are a lot of similarities. The verbiage changes a little bit, closing somebody out in basketball. I don't know if we would necessarily say that in soccer. We kind of say, you got to mark that person. Guarding versus defending kind of thing. Those two terms get used interchangeably. But, there's kind of little things that you see kind of cross, I guess, with both sports, the mechanics of deceleration, kind of using your kind of hips and body to kind of show a person one way or the other. And those things go across a lot of team sports. So for me, it was kind of interesting having I guess less biases when it comes to the training aspect of how technically and tactically basketballers are trained. I think having a lot of background in soccer and playing soccer and working in soccer as a support staff member, you kind of get some developed biases of what you believe is the right way to train somebody technically and tactically. Even if that's not my role as a strength and conditioning coach, you still have that little lens, I think, sometimes. So being able to come into it with a bit more of a blank canvas allowed me to really do what we talk about, I think, in strength and conditioning with having that planned needs analysis, kind of understanding kind of the physiological, technical aspects of the performance, and then how I kind of interplay into that and working with people. So it's been a fun thing. And again, get to ask more questions when you know less about some stuff. So being able to be in the NBA environment was super cool. We had a lot of player development coaches who I spent a lot of time with, where we could just talk and like chop it up in terms of like, hey, what do you see when you're working with this guy? And like, they'll give you all that kind of technical aspect that like maybe you wouldn't get necessarily somewhere else. So it was really useful for me, I think, particularly having those 2 years to like really fully embed myself in the pro world. Because now I've taken a lot of that stuff and applied it in the college setting, which has been really cool.
Yeah, and at times applying that in the college setting can be tricky, right? Because of the rules and the time that we're allotted. And, sure, you know, these kids have to go to class once or twice, you know, every now and then. I'm sure at Penn, you know, school is definitely optional at all times. You know, but I think that the terminology and understanding the game of soccer is something that was really beneficial for me, especially early on, you know, with the system we run being more, I guess we could call it Princeton-y. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the people say that it's this really intricate and difficult thing to figure out. It's just a way of creating and filling space, which is all you do in soccer, to try to keep possession of the ball. And how you guard is just simple pressure, cover, balance. You know, but they like to call it, you know, close out, ball pressure, and being in the gaps, you know. So it's like having that point of view as an outsider, but understand the unique thing that we are fortunate to have. But you touched upon something that I want to kind of swing back to. You know, you were talking about, you know, player development and the technical tactical aspects. And with your background and your skill set in applied sports science, you know, nowadays everybody's got, you know, 10,000 different toys and a trillion different metrics that they're taking. I think all too often we see people pulling a lot of data, but not really knowing what they're looking at. And I think that that's really what's starting to kind of hamstring us as we continue to move forward. So where do you see that? Where do you see the role of these pieces of technology and these metrics when it comes to us improving the actual outcomes and developing better technical, tactical skills and understanding what does and doesn't matter when it comes to their development?
For sure. I think first and foremost, like, data has become the new currency in kind of the world, but particularly in sport, right? Like, we're trying to obviously understand how to get the best things out of performance and other little aspects like injury and stuff like that. And of course, with that comes kind of that development of technologies to be able to measure this sort of stuff. And I think what kind of has happened is like those like phases of development where it's like you've got the early adopters, right, who just kind of buy the tech and don't really know exactly what it's going to give them, but try and figure it out. And then kind of like these more like late adopters that like see these other teams using it. And it's like, oh, we might need this as well. And again, they might not have necessarily always like created the need and infrastructure for it straight away. So a lot of times what I kind of see with tech is kind of like those two aspects. It's like you buy it without the original question, or you see somebody else using it and it's kind of like, oh, this could be important for us. And so a big kind of part of that is obviously like starting with like the original thing, the question that you're trying to answer. So whether it is trying to understand something from a performance aspect of like, okay, what is a KPI for basketball? It might be somebody doing jumps or something like that. So we want to measure some jump height. And obviously there's various technologies and things like that exist in the field to be able to do that. And recently, not to segue on this, but recently there was like this discussion on on Twitter where kind of we were talking about measuring jump height and like how a Vertec measures a jump height versus a contact mat versus a force plate and how all of those things measure jump height, but in a different way. And I think it caused some confusion, like why there was differences in that. And kind of the simple answer is they're just different technologies. They measure it in slightly different measurement kind of tool ways, like Vertec, kind of that reach and jump height kind of metric versus like a force plate, which if you use like impulse momentum, you're measuring the estimated center of mass displacement and change. So again, people kind of then was like, well, which one's the right one? And it's kind of like, well, what are you trying to measure? If you want to measure something like center of mass displacement, then force plate is probably your best measure for that. if you're trying to measure true jump height, then maybe actually like the vertec might be the best thing if it's performed correctly and you calculate the person's reach and things like that, because that might be more reflective of like the performance of basketball where you're like rebounding or you're going up for a dunk or something like that, versus kind of this more like force plate measure, which we might use more for kind of neuromuscular kind of function and things like that. So I think like a big thing with the tech is like, again, understanding kind of what the measurement is. And within that, it's understanding kind of what the uncertainty in the measurement is. And I think a lot of times in sport, we kind of forget that aspect. But if we really truly understand the uncertainty, I think it just unlocks every door, really, because then you know exactly what your measurement's giving you and like how much like it has to kind of change by what the error is before you can start saying, hey, this guy's improved or this guy has got worse, or I'm monitoring fatigue and this is a change that I need to go and talk to coach about. So a big part of that for me is definitely like the uncertainty in some of these technologies. And I'm going to be honest, there's certain ones that are better than others. I did my PhD in sleep, so it was kind of well-versed in terms of reading around like applied sleep monitoring devices and things like that. And a lot of the time, these things are telling you like deep sleep and REM and things like that. But realistically, they're just like guessing in a sense, like they've got an algorithm estimation. And basically they're just telling you, they're just telling you kind of like, oh yeah, you got 3 hours of deep sleep. But when you actually start to like look at it against polysomnography, like it's close and like they've done some correction equations, but truly they don't know that it's deep sleep if it's like a heart rate measure or something like that, or a movement measure. So all of a sudden it's kind of like, all right, we got to throw that side of the data out. It might be really good at telling us when you're awake and when you're asleep, and that might be all we need to use a thing for. So again, kind of understanding these like technology pieces and where kind of like the measurements come from are probably the most important aspects and stage of that. And then all of a sudden you start realizing that we may have spent some money on some stuff that we probably could have done for more value. Like if you're really interested in monitoring sleep, for example, you could just get somebody to do a sleep diary for free, like pen and paper, if it's like that kind of easy. So again, there's like little things I think within sport where sometimes we become like embedded with the technology before we truly understand it. So definitely for me, the first part and step of that is understanding what this like measurement does, if that makes sense.
No, 100%. And I think that's two really big things. Like if you don't really know if it's measuring what it says it measures, and you don't really understand what it's saying that it measures or what it actually is telling you that it measures, then you're starting to make decisions off things that may or may not be valid. And when you start manipulating, whether it be training loads or day-to-day activities or lifestyle changes off of things that, you know, like some of the things we know with these sleep monitors is a borderline algorithmic guess, right? But some of them can show you some good things, right? Like the effects of eating too late, the effects of alcohol, the effects of dehydration, the effects of finals and stress and all those things, and whether, you know, you actually are sleeping through the night or not. But with that being said, if you also want to sit here and try to believe that they have your sleep patterns in your, you know, your REM to deep to light, you know, sleep pattern, you know, to a T, I mean, you would hope that people understand that that's just an estimation at best, and that you can pick what the driving factors to making decisions are, and understanding how you need to be the person to pull the data that matters to answer the questions that you have, or even better, to find better questions that you didn't know you needed to ask yet.
For sure. I think you hit the nail on the head with the kind of every measure being an estimation, right? And that's kind of like one thing I think particularly through my PhD, was kind of learning about measurements and measurement error. And like, once you kind of like get a little bit of a handle on that, I would say I'm by no means an expert in that area, but all of a sudden you kind of like, oh, okay. Like if this is an estimation, how much do I need it to change by to really truthfully think about communicating this aspect of data? So a lot of the times, like I might not be like communicating to a coach because like something just hasn't changed. Like I don't need to report like trivial changes, if that makes sense. So all of a sudden that makes my life a little bit easier in communication and delivery. Cause when me and coach have this touch point, it's about something that we have got a little bit more certainty about and probability about that, that it has changed. So all of a sudden it kind of revamps the, in my eyes, the way sports science delivery is in the sports performance world, where again, we have this abundance of data. And I think the death by data kind of phrase can be very true in organizations. And the one thing I always think about is like, I only get limited time with coaches here and with my athletes, particularly at the college level. So it's kind of like, I got to be more sensible with what I communicate, so I don't actually kind of like drown them in data as well, if that makes sense. So all of a sudden I've kind of got this like better perspective around, all right, all these kind of things where like, I don't know, we do week to week jumps. And if half my team isn't changing, I'm not necessarily running into coach, hey, we haven't changed in our jumps, blah, blah, blah. Like we might have that like off conversation, but I'm not creating a report that kind of doesn't really show him much. But then when the one or two athletes who do improve that we've been working on, or an athlete might go down in a certain sense, now I kind of bring that to the table. So it's kind of a little bit more fluid in terms of reporting style, rather than like sending six different PDFs because we're collecting bunches of data from different sources. So all of a sudden it's kind of like you start communicating like what I believe is the most essential information. So you're not drowning people with data as well.
Dude, I think that that hits like so many important things that people, they overlook. You know, we talk about all too often, right, that we need to be more efficient in our collection with what we're collecting, because when you provide, when you have jump mats or force plates and polar or catapult or both, and you're weighing them in and out and doing hydration stuff, and you're tracking lifts and you're testing fly 10s or 40s or whatever, and you're just testing. And these kids eventually are just going to be like, bro, like, like, what are we doing? Like, so we've come to that realization. For the most part, I think a lot of people have come to the realization that you have to be more efficient with the metrics you collect. But I still think there's many of us who are not very efficient with communicating the, or choosing the times to communicate the metrics that we do collect. You know, I'm really lucky with our sports medicine practitioner in the queue, Andy. You know, we talk about what we're doing, and you know, we're looking at the heart rate and the load data and the speed data from practice versus what our norms are and where we're at in the week and all those things, and talking about stuff. And unless we see like a huge red flag, I think that he's maybe brought things to the coach's attention twice this season. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to guys once or twice about a couple things, but it's because if you just keep going to them and you're like, oh yeah, here's a little bit. Oh, here's a little bit. Oh, here's a little bit. And like eventually it's like, yo, Chicken Little, like, is the sky really falling, or is this not, you know, like, what are you doing? You're wasting our time. And then, you know, when you do go to them and you talk to them and you're like, hey, now all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute. Like, you know, JD doesn't usually bring this stuff up. This might actually be important. We should take this into consideration. Like, if it's something that he doesn't think he can correct and he can fix, fix is probably the wrong word, but I hope everyone listening knows what I mean. Like, then he's saying he needs help with addressing this. We need to take a look at what we're doing. And now you've opened the door even more, right? Because you're not just sitting there talking their ear off about a bunch of things that, no offense to them, they really don't know what you're talking about. And no offense to us, for the most part, they couldn't care less what we're talking about, right? They're just like, can they practice or not? Like, are we going to be good tomorrow or not? Like, that's all they care about. And rightfully so, right? It's our job to care about the rest of that stuff, to have them ready for practice, to make sure that they're progressing properly, to make sure that their health and wellness and well-being and all those things are in the forefront. But if you keep just throwing like, oh, here's a little thing, here's a little thing, here's a little thing, here's a little thing, when you can just take care of it, like, I couldn't agree more, man. Then they're going to start tuning you out and you're just going to be, you know, like Charlie Brown's teacher at the end. For sure. Gosh, I hope people know what Charlie Brown's teacher sounds like, or I might have just really dated myself on this podcast. But anyway.
I got it, although Charlie Brown was a little young for me, I've got to say. But yeah, I think, again, like, I completely agree with all of that. And I think one of the big things that really, I guess, like, impacted me in my career was actually going to the pro level with the NBA and how we kind of utilize data and data collection. Again, I won't go into too many details as I'm no longer at the organization, but like, getting the athletes involved in the data process is like pretty much 50% of the battle. So trying to like integrate monitoring into training was kind of the big, I guess, challenge for us and like goal for us, versus kind of like this more, I guess, in the past I've been used to it, particularly at the Nike Academy, where we'd have more formalized assessments prior to practice, talk to coaches, communicate the data, potentially change practice based on what we were seeing with the data stuff. Everything else was kind of like bonus on top of that. Whereas like kind of at the NBA level, it kind of mentioned, it's like, all right, are they available for training? Yes or no? Yes. Are they available for competition tomorrow? Yes. Okay, cool. That was kind of like the gist of the conversations, whether a force plate metric was slightly trending in a certain direction. The one thing I learned, particularly at that level, was pretty much most of the guys aren't playing at 100% every night. So back-to-backs, long West Coast road trips, things like that. All of a sudden, like, they're 75%, and I'm just making up numbers, they're 75% is probably better than most people's 100% sometimes. So again, like, you kind of more so angle towards like, hey, keeping people available and communicating that message, versus like the dirty word, I guess, in the NBA is the load management thing. And load management sometimes, I think, is just more so what I would call like simple decision making. It's kind of like, all right, this guy's played X amount of minutes over the past few weeks. He says he feels tired. He's got knee tendonitis or something like that. Like, do we want to take the risk of him playing in this game, sort of thing? And that's kind of like been more my experience of load management than it being like, oh, his Connexon numbers are too high, he's done too much in practice, like, we got to hold him back. It's more so kind of like how that person and that person's body is responding, and then the medical and performance team making decisions around what that person should do next. And realistically, you're going to be a little bit more conservative at times, where it's like, if it is your all-star player who's saying, yeah, I don't really feel like I can play, are we going to force this guy to play, kind of thing? Like, we need him, but at the same time, like, you're not always going to be able to force people to play. So I think that kind of happens a lot as well, with kind of, sometimes you're not even necessarily like using the data, you're just using your kind of best common sense decision makers sometimes. And conversations, quite honestly, particularly at that level, go way further than some metrics on a force plate or things like that. But obviously you get a little bit more time to be individualized and have those conversations on a day-to-day basis. That's the thing I would say is a big differentiator to kind of where I'm at now with college, where still I have, I guess, two teams with women's basketball, men's basketball, about 32 athletes. So I can get to most people and get a touch point with most people on a day-to-day basis, but it's harder to have those like deeper, meaningful conversations on a day-to-day basis. Whereas at the NBA level, you kind of few guys that kind of come in the facility, warm up with you, stuff like that. You can speak a lot more in detail about, hey, how are you feeling? Like, what's been going good for you recently? Like, those sort of things. And you can have it obviously at a much easier scaled level. And I used to, I'm going to be honest, I used to in the past be a non-believer of like the, oh, like the conversations are your readiness type tool, if you know what I mean. And that was probably more my naivety of being a younger practitioner and also being in an environment where we were like collecting readiness for every guy on a day-to-day basis and not seeing the kind of troubles that certain organizations have with collecting those measures. So again, sometimes like getting the the readiness questionnaire or an RPE questionnaire off a guy at the before or end of practice is really difficult. And people will just put joke answers. Whereas like conversation wise, they'll probably tell you a little bit more truths. Again, practically it's scalable, right? Like I look at our football coach at UPenn, it's like the amount of athletes he sees and has touch points with on a day-to-day basis, maybe a readiness questionnaire that they do truthfully, honestly answer is more fit to purpose. But for certain environments, I think like you just got to make that audible call of, I can probably speak to these guys and figure out more information because they've got to come through the training room. They've got to come through the weight room versus like, I've got an organization of 150 athletes. All of a sudden I can't have conversations with every one of those guys. So I think that's another like kind of important aspect. I know I just rambled there a little bit, but I think that makes sense in my mind.
No, but I think that when you bring it all together, right, like it's understanding what evaluation is providing you the best possible data with the least invasive methods being attached to it, right? You know, we look at a lot of these things. You talked about this. There's error in everything. Like there're devices. There's error in, you know, accelerometers. There's error in GPS readings. There's error in heart rate straps and watches and things like that. But you need to then determine A, what the error is to an extent, and B, how much is going to be acceptable, right? Because if you want perfect, you can't use anything, you know, but if you want, you have to determine what is good enough to help you drive decisions when you're looking at the technology that you utilize. And then you need to figure out what questions you're trying to answer. And I think that coming all the way back, I mean, shoot, dude, I am the Omega Wave guy. That's what people like to say. You know, we were one of the first ones to use it in college basketball. We don't use it now. I love it. I think it's fantastic. I think that that technology can drive more decisions and provide better input into how you want to handle an athlete in more directions than anything out there. Because you can look at the autonomic nervous system. You can look at the central nervous system. You can look at the functioning state of your cardiac system and all these things that are great. But if the kids loathe coming to breakfast to get a reading and it impacts all the other things that you're trying to do, is it worth it? You know, like, and I think that you really hit the nail on the head there, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask, because so much of this has been about efficiency and understanding what you're looking at and understanding how you need to look at and communicate this. What are some ways that you have found through your evolution as a, you know, applied sports scientist and strength and conditioning coach, where you've been able to better evaluate what metrics you're taking and the technology you're utilizing for it? And what are some simple things that you think coaches could do to make sure that what they're communicating is actually what they're seeing?
For sure. That's a really good question, actually. And quite honestly, it's been something that I've probably done iteratively as I've kind of gone through different organizations and been exposed to, again, early in my career. You mentioned like Omega Wave and things like that. Like at Nike Academy, we were also one of the first users of Omega Wave in the UK, I believe. And then we moved to First Beat, and then we were using Polar after that. And like we were doing some raw sampling of HRV on that. And I guess I got exposed to an environment where we had an abundance of technology. And quite honestly, myself and my colleague, who was called Chris Thorpe, we didn't know what to do. If you know what I mean, it's kind of like we were collecting all this data, and all of a sudden it's like we never had a process to start with. And so that's kind of where I honestly start these days is, okay, like, what is my process? And I even look back in terms of my strength conditioning delivery, and like here at UPenn, I use a way more less technology than I've ever used in my whole career. But I would say my process and the delivery of that process with the limited amount of data that I'm collecting is actually more enhanced now. And that's not to say it's like enhanced in terms of I have the best, most perfect program, but even just going scaling back down to using contact mats for jump height, engaging my athletes in that process, like having it as be a part of training. It's not just a standalone assessment. Whereas previously, when I first got here, we were using force plate technology and we would get them to jump before the session starts after a little warm up and then go into the session. Now it's kind of like integrated into my session warm up. So all of a sudden, jumps are just something that we do. And then I basically run this system of, okay, if you are outside of your average, so we take the standard error of the measurement, we create a small detectable change score. So if a person on that day is outside their average, and I'm using the past 10 tests, so technically it's 10 weeks for us, then they do a gain workout. And we basically gain is a little bit higher volume loads, more intensity, a little linear increase in intensity at the moment in season. If you're within your norms, we do a maintain workout. And that kind of most for kind of our primary lifts is flat loaded. We use VBT. So we monitor some speed zones, make sure they're in the specific speed zone for what we're doing, whether it's a trap bar jump or deadlift, whatever we're doing that day. And then if you're outside of your jump height norms and below that, you do your restore workout, which is kind of a little bit more mobility focus, some isometrics and things like that. And again, some of this isn't scientifically like, hey, if you do gain, you're going to get better or anything like that. But it's just been a way to engage my athletes in the actual monitoring process. So what I've been seeing is jumps have just been going up as a product of just doing this. And like week to week, we're kind of trending in the right direction. So again, I can communicate to coach, hey, whatever we're doing is kind of working. And so not for every week, obviously, but we've seen some PRs and jump height happen at this point in the season, and we're deep into our conference play now. Whereas like last year, looking back at some data, we kind of were stale or people weren't kind of jumping as high. And I think it was quite honestly because of the process and not because of the actual like them being fatigued and stuff like that. I think the process was more monotonous in that sense. So all of a sudden they're kind of like, we've got people now who even despite their jumps, like they're not getting many minutes or something like that. So like, well, I'm not doing maintain anymore. I'm doing a gain workout. So all of a sudden I've like, it's one measure, it's jump height. And we know from a fatigue standpoint that potentially we could kind of cheat jump height in a way where our strategy, we might take a little bit longer ground contact time or something like that to generate the impulse to get the jump height. So I accept that. Again, it's not the gold standard like force plate technology where I'm looking at multiple variables and saying, hey, mechanistically, with your outputs that you've been able to truly improve and you should do gain. But as a performance output and a single measure and to do it quick and the quick and dirty way, jump height is good enough for us right now. So again, like that just was like one very simple example where like in the past, I would be like, banging on the door, hey, we've got a monitor, force plate technology. And even then I did have in the past a similar process where from the force plates we'd use jump height, but then it's kind of like, if that's where I'm getting the most effectiveness with my training and my process, like, do I need to spend X amount of thousands of dollars to have the added layer? Now, personally, yeah, I would be interested in kind of the strategy that people use to create that jump height performance and things like that. But then there's some of my colleagues where it's like they've not had much exposure or very little exposure with force plate technology. So actually just understanding jump height is kind of the first level and how that measure varies week to week and day to day. So again, that's kind of one way of like what I've used where we take that uncertainty in the measure. We know it does vary from a week to week perspective and create kind of a process around it. And then it adds that layer of being able to communicate to coach like, hey, our jumps are going in the right direction. Another like kind of simple one is like we do weigh-ins for our men's basketball team before every workout. Is it a little bit too much to do it so many times in the week? But they just love doing it. They're kind of like, hey, I'm 205 today, blah, 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 I'm up kind of thing. And all of a sudden it changes the psychology around like, hey, I feel strong and big, you know? And like realistically, again, we know body weight can vary by a few pounds just throughout the day. So it's kind of like funny in terms of like the little things that people are most kind of focused in and feel like are the most important things. Sometimes scientifically, we'd be like, well, jump height doesn't really detect fatigue. So what Craig's doing with his restore workouts are a bunch of nonsense kind of thing. But the times where jump height performance does go down, it truly does go down. They probably need that restore workout, in my opinion. So that's kind of like one example that I've kind of used more recently. And we did a little bit of an adaptation of that with the Sixers. But as I said, it was harder to get people to jump more consistently. So I wasn't as week-to-week based with that. It was kind of like a more monthly assessment. And then the other thing that I would say where like people can kind of, I guess, avoid this like death by data and figure out what's the most important things is honestly speak to the people who are like most important, the head coaches, GMs, even the athletes, and like understand kind of like what is meaningful to them. So like one thing that I like talk about on a month-to-month basis is, again, body weight. Like, is it the most important aspect? Is it the biggest KPI predictor for performance in that sport? Maybe like certain positions, but again, like coach is interested in it. He wants to know where people are going. He doesn't want people losing dramatic amount of weight during the season. So that's an easy win for me where it's like, we can collect that information on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. And then I have to communicate that at the end of the month. But it started with that conversation of, hey coach, what are you interested in seeing? Like, do you want to see volume loads week to week that we're doing in the gym? And guys are like, what the fuck is volume load? Pardon my French. So like all of a sudden you're like kind of talking about things where like, realistically they don't really care that much. And then even honestly, like the communication of data is another one that I think is like an important aspect of, I've spoke to Patrick Ward over at the Seahawks a lot about this. I probably pester him too much about this, but it's like, sometimes you kind of like think, oh, it has to be like the most perfect like data visual. And there's a lot of stuff now with like the kind of R coding and data visualization, Tableau, all these tools. And like, sometimes like coaches are just so used to box scores that actually just a table of information is way more valuable than kind of any like box plot with individual data points and lines and thresholds for change and things like that. Like, maybe actually all they want to see is just a box score kind of thing. And that's again been another aha moment for me, particularly transitioning from soccer to basketball, where like we didn't really use box scores as stats within soccer as much. But within basketball, it's the number one thing that a coach is used to just reading off the sheet, right? So all of a sudden, like my reports are a little less visually appeasing sometimes, just because of that fact of like understanding what that person wants to see. And sometimes I kind of like, there's another layer of this. And then that's where I might bring in the data visualization. But again, creating things that like people actually want to use and then affect their process with versus kind of like, hey, this is the best way to visualize this data. And then they look at it and go, well, it's nice and colorful, but what do I get out of this information, if you know what I mean?
Dude, I mean, unbelievable. Yes. And it's crazy to think about it, right? That we probably want these things to look better and have more information and be fancier than is ever needed. And I think that, you know, there's some really awesome takeaways from this talk, Doc. You know, I mean, obviously the first one that we started with where you're talking about, you got to understand what you're trying to understand. Like, if you don't know what you're trying to figure out or find out with the tech you're using or the monitoring program you're implementing, you're just collecting to collect, and that's not going to help anybody. And then understanding the pros and cons of what you've collected, the systems you're using to collect them, and what fits and what doesn't, and where there may be some issues with it is the next most important thing. So you can actually understand what you're communicating. And then that last point that you just brought up, the simple fact of just keeping it simple and meeting them where they're at, you know, like, this stinks, man. But you know what? Most of the stuff we do, nobody cares about. like it's the honest to God, like the 7,000 people that were at our game Saturday probably care more about the fact that I put a stool out for a timeout than what special exercises we did this morning with the 7 o'clock group. You know, like, hey, everybody listening to this podcast probably thinks the exercises are cool, but the people that pay the money, that pay our jobs, they couldn't care less. So, like, when we're sitting here trying to force this information down people's throats, of course it gets us in trouble. And I think that that's something that, honestly, man, I had to get smacked in the face with. And I'm really glad that, you know, you're able to share that and bring that to the people that are listening today, man, because this has been an absolutely rad 40 minutes. But before we get out of here, Doc, like, where can people learn more about you, see more from you? What are your socials so they can track what you're doing?
Yeah, I think I'm most active on Twitter. My at is CT Sports I. Generally see me chopping it up with getting into some like discussions. I guess I play devil's advocate a little bit on Twitter a lot. So that's probably the main one. Also email ctsportsi@gmail.com. Generally answer a lot of emails there. Part of my website, ctsportscience.com. So they're generally the most easy places to get me on. I am about to start posting on Instagram again, same handle. So generally, most of the time you can get me on Twitter. That's probably the best place socially for sure.
That's easy, man. CT Sports Sci on Twitter, soon to be Instagram.com and at gmail.com. That makes it work.
Try and keep it simple, you know what I mean?
No doubt. Well, Doc, truly appreciate your time. This is fantastic, man. And really look forward to catching up again soon. Thank you so much.
Appreciate you, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. And as always, thank you for everything that y'all do for us here at Central Virginia Sport Performance. We'll be back next week with another awesome guest. We will see you then.